All right, and we'll move on to the fourth case of this morning, which is Marrick against Grosshan. Mr. Hennig?
Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Robert Hennig. I represent Dale Marrick on this appeal. We are appealing from the denial of Mr. Marrick's 2254 petition. There are essentially two issues before the court. First is ineffectiveness of trial counsel based on counsel's failure to interview or investigate and call character witnesses who would be able to attest to Mr. Marrick's good character for honesty. The second involves the district court's denial of our request for discovery. We were trying to get evidence which would corroborate existing evidence, which we believe suggests that the investigating detective and an active member of the prosecution team perjured himself and falsified evidence at trial in order to rehabilitate the testimony or the credibility of the state's full transactional witness. I'd like to focus on the character witness issue. However, I'm more than willing to address any questions the court may have on the second issue. Obviously, for an ineffectiveness claim, there are two issues, two points that we need to establish. First is deficient performance. Second is resulting prejudice.
Could I just clarify that your argument really only pertains to these two witnesses, Renner and Leeske, who were not arguably within some range of strategic choice on defense counsel's part?
They are examples of the types of witnesses, yes. They're the only ones that testified at the Mockner hearing, the post-conviction motion hearing. So we can say that those are the only ones we're really addressing. There was a third witness who also did not fall within the category of knowing Mr. Marrick through scouting, who testified at the sentencing hearing, another older gentleman who also testified to his good character. But essentially, it's those two witnesses, Mr. Renner and Ms. Leeske.
Now, had they testified, if we assume for the time being that it was deficient performance not to have them do it, and if we move to the prejudice side of the Strickland inquiry, which I understand really is what the Wisconsin courts were looking at, they could not have testified in any particular detail. They would have stood up and said, I think Mr. Marrick has the character and reputation for truthfulness, basically. I've known him for, you know, X number of years, longer time in one case than the other. Why, in your view, was it downright unreasonable for the Wisconsin courts to find that this really just wasn't going to have enough of an impact on the result to justify relief?
Well, first of all, the circuit court decision that then was basically adopted by the Court of Appeals decision appears to me to be based on at least in part on the idea that character evidence can never be sufficient to justify a showing of prejudice. That character witnesses are never so crucial to a case that it could create a reasonable probability of a different result. I think that the U.S. Supreme Court in Edgington and Mickelson, this court in Burke, even the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Kyler, all have recognized that in a close case, and I would submit to the court that this is such a close case, in which it is basically one person's word against another, where credibility is the issue.
Well, it's a lot more than one person's word against the other. Once he is admitted being in bed with the... that's the big issue. If he said, I was never there, then you got one person's word against the other.
Well,
it is a lot more than that here for the state's position.
Well, all that the state has to say that there was a crime here, perhaps a lack of judgment in entering this bed, but an actual crime of sexual contact. All they have is Mr. Holzbauer's word, whether it's his testimony at trial or whether it is his prior statements to other people. All they have is his word that that's what happened. There is no physical evidence to corroborate that. There are no other eyewitnesses who would corroborate that, even though there were two other people in the room. The only evidence they have that Mr. Merrick committed the sexual contact is this young man's word. And if we look at what he says, when we take into account how close this case is under Eggers, we have to look at how strong the state's case is, because obviously a stronger case can survive errors. They won't have as much of an effect as a weak state's case. And we start with the state being saddled by the fact that this is just plain bizarre, that a person, Dale Merrick, who has been a friend of the family for years, has known this person for years, has never done anything inappropriate, even though they had occupied the same bed together on several other occasions, has never shown any sexual attractiveness to this young man. All the situations, all of a sudden, one night, would decide to start sucking on the kid's sexual organ. That's just bizarre. It's surrealistic. A jury easily could look at that as something that is a dream, a vivid dream, but a dream nonetheless. And when we take into account the fact that what Mr. Merrick is charged with, was convicted of, is sexual contact of a unconscious person. The reason why that is a crime is because an unconscious person does not have the judgment or the ability to perceive things to make a valid consent. So we're starting off with a weak case. Sufficient nonetheless, a jury reasonably could convict based on that evidence, but we're starting off with a weak state case. We add to that the fact that Mr. Merrick's testimony is not inherently incredible. There's nothing unreasonable about his testimony. He was not substantially impeached in any way. He made a lack of judgment in entering that bed that night, and I am sure that a day has not passed when he has not wished that he would have made a different choice of sleeping arrangements that night. But that is not a crime. And it is a situation that had occurred previously with absolutely no sexual contact. So this is not something that is out of the ordinary in this situation. I understand that in the usual case, character evidence would not be sufficient to show a reasonable probability of a different result. But in a case like this, I believe that it is. The state courts did not address any of those issues, did not address the strength of the state's case. It just made a bald statement that this was not egregious enough. And I submit to you that that is unreasonable. They did not address the relevant factors, and if they had, they would have reached a different conclusion. Seeing that I am into my rebuttal time, I thank the court.
Thank you. Mr. Fryman.
May it please the court. I am Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General James Fryman, representing the appellee state official in this 2254 habeas appeal. Appellant Merrick stands convicted of 3 counts of second-degree sexual assault. They've been affirmed both on direct appeal and collateral review in the state courts, and the district court has denied habeas relief. The state asks this court to affirm the district court's decision. With respect, I'll focus on the first issue, but at the outset I'd like to just summarize the state's position on both of the issues presented. First, in rejecting Merrick's claim that his trial counsel was ineffective for not calling certain character witnesses, and as I understand it now, it's 2 in particular, 2 character witnesses, simply to give opinions on whether Merrick is truthful, the state courts ruled in a manner that is neither contrary to nor an unreasonable application of Strickland versus Washington. As I further understand it, in this case, we're really looking at the unreasonable application because there is not a claim that this case has materially indistinguishable facts from any other U.S. Supreme Court case.
Now, you don't understand state court's rulings to be that character witness could never be the kind of person. Is it on the basis of these facts somehow?
Right. The state courts are not, as I understand it, the state courts are not suggesting that in a particular case a character witness could be a vital witness for the defense, and failure to adduce that witness or to present that witness could result in ineffective assistance of counsel.
And why isn't it this case? I mean, given the nature of the circumstances.
First, I think any juror, if these 2 witnesses who are friends of Mr. Merrick, and as I understand it, it's through business associations, both of them are with the same business in Milwaukee, so and not an employee relationship, I don't think. There might have been some
situation where he helped out. A juror would understand that these are friends of the defendant. And these witnesses, if called to testify, would be saying simply, I believe, based on my contacts, and these are everyday occurrences, normal activities of life, that this is a truthful person. One thing that I didn't do in my brief that I think may be worth pointing out is that Mr. Merrick really hasn't articulated that these are reputational witnesses in the sense of that they could give an opinion about his community-wide reputation for truthfulness, that these are just based on my opinion, my contacts, this is what I would say. I think it's important to remember that these were not transactional witnesses, these were not alibi witnesses, nor were these penalty phase witnesses testifying in mitigation of Mr. Merrick's sentence. These are simply fringe witnesses. I also think that the jury wasn't left without evidence as to Mr. Merrick's good character. For example, jurors heard that he held a responsible computer job with the state of Wisconsin, that he had attended Marquette University for a number of years, and that he had no criminal record, which the state didn't object to the defense putting in. They also knew that he was a longtime friend of the complainant Allen's father, that he had enjoyed a good relationship with Allen until this incident, and that he had even slept in the same bed with Allen before without incident. I think under these circumstances, Allen's account of sexual assault truly, as opposing counsel said, was a bizarre incident, but I think the bizarreness starts with the fact that here, Mr. Merrick forewent an opportunity to sleep in an empty, vacant bed, decided to crawl into bed, a small bed, with two teenage boys on the night in question. Mr. Merrick is no small man. He's 6 foot tall, 200 pounds, according to the record. Understandably, the complainant was afraid to tell his stepfather because of the relationship between the stepfather and Mr. Merrick, and he eventually told the security guard at school, someone with whom he had developed a rapport and trusted. There was no evidence of a motive to falsely accuse Mr. Merrick. The defense at trial was that he dreamed it or that he's lying. As this court recognized in United States versus Burke, people of impeccable reputation may commit crimes, and when they're charged with crime, the question is whether they did it, not whether they enjoy high social standing.
But the question for us really is whether the Wisconsin courts unreasonably applied the prejudice part of Strickland in a case that really does boil down to one person's word against another, even though the complaining person then tells some other people, so he's given his version to several. And why wouldn't we reach the reasonable probability level when the jury instead just sees nothing? They see Merrick and they see this kid who's told a variety of girlfriend, the school security guard, eventually others, about what happened. That couldn't have tipped the balance at all, in your view?
A couple of responses on that. At first, the level we're at, I think, the deferential review that's necessary to the state court resolution of this issue. Within that deference, also, the trial court was the post-conviction court that heard this. So the trial court had a sense, also heard the post-conviction testimony. And I think given that situation and given the factors that I mentioned earlier, these are fringe witnesses. These are not people who were there. And I think a reasonable juror could even look at these witnesses and say, if that's all the defendant can offer in rebuttal here, I mean, sexual assaults invariably or not frequently occur in a setting where there's he said, she said, or in this case, he said. And it's just the nature of the offense a lot of times. And I just don't think to fault counsel here just for not presenting two fringe witnesses, especially given everything else that occurred, and the jury knew all about Mr. Merrick or knew sufficiently about his character, that the state court's decision here was not an unreasonable application of Strickland. Just on the memo book issue, there was no certificate of appealability granted on that, and we addressed that in our brief as well as the merits of the memo book issue. The only difference as I see it is that the same reasons that would apply for denying habeas relief would apply under a lesser standard for expanding the certificates to Mr. Merrick. So the same reason, a lesser standard first to get it reviewed on appeal, and then the greater standard to deny relief. If there are no further questions, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hennig? 2 minutes, Mr. Hennig.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. First of all, it would be a rare case in which someone who has a good opinion of someone's truthfulness, in which they would not be, you know, a friend or an acquaintance. There is going to be some kind of connection there. So saying that they should be disbelieved automatically because they're friends, that's an issue for the jury to decide, but it does not make them inherently incredible. I don't think it's quite accurate to say that the jury only saw the witnesses on the two sides, Mr. Merrick and Mr. Holzbauer. Unfortunately, they also saw defense counsel trying to elicit good character witness or good character evidence from the complainant's father,
which backfired. Yes.
Yes, with dramatic results. And finally, the state asked that this court grant an additional level, I believe, of deferential review to the state court's decision. I believe that the reasonableness analysis required under the anti-terrorism amendments is the deferential review that is required, and there is no extra level of deference that is either justified or permitted in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.